It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. That's right, peppy music that is there.
It is, and I feel much more energetic from hearing it. So let's start out.
Why don't we start where Ben stopped?
Okay. The new newspaper owners in town and across Washington State.
Not just Washington State, as Ben Magdigian was just mentioning. McClatchy bought Knight Ridder this week, which by circulation is the second largest newspaper chain in America after Gannett. But McClatchy is, they're based in Sacramento. Their original paper was the Sacramento Bee. But their biggest area of concentration is actually the Pacific Northwest, and particularly Washington State. Now they've bought Knight Ridder's 49% share of the Seattle Times, which actually doesn't give them anything other than a seat on the board to listen to what Frank Blethyn wants to do, and dividends whenever Frank Blethyn decides to give them any. The relationship between Blethyn and Knight Ridder was notoriously stormy. The only thing the Times really got out of the deal was free subscription to Knight Ridder's news service. But we'll see whether McClatchy has any influence on Knight Ridder. But more interesting is all the other papers in the area that Knight Ridder owns, including the Tacoma News Tribune, which it's not entirely clear whether they may have to spin that off because of overlap and coverage area. The News Tribune has pulled back the last couple of years. Several years ago, they were trying pretty hard to make inroads, particularly into South King County, and they've gone back and forth, and the Times has gone back and forth in terms of trying to get into Tacoma over the years. So there is some overlap there. There's also some overlap between the Tacoma News Tribune and the Olympian, which they also own. They bought the Olympian and the Bellingham Herald from Gannett about a year ago. Knight Ridder did, and now they've been sold again to McClatchy. They also own the paper in Tri-Cities. I believe they own Yakima, I'm not sure of that. They own Boise. They own Anchorage. What they have really is the largest concentration of media ownership right now in the Pacific Northwest. They're going to be a huge influence on regional and national advertising agency buys. And they also will have a lot of influence deciding on upon what they do with potential cuts in newsroom staffs, which almost invariably follow corporate acquisitions of large newspaper chains, because the chains have to put up so much money to buy each other. Depending on whether there are newsroom cuts and how much of it there are, it's going to affect local political coverage across the Pacific Northwest, and that's a really bad thing.
Yeah, the Tacoma News Tribune, I don't know about their overall coverage, but their coverage on certain issues that I'm interested in has been outstanding in the past.
Yeah, they have been, for the size market that they are in and the fact that they're so overshadowed by Seattle in so many ways, the Tacoma News Tribune is actually a pretty good newspaper. You know, what McClatchy does with it is an open question.
Mm. All right.
Or even if McClatchy keeps it, that may be one of the 12 papers that McClatchy decides to spin off.
Mm. All right. We'll come back to local events at the end of the show. Let's jump to national and Russ Feingold making a name for himself this week.
Yeah, for 5 years now, for 3 months now. It's been 5 years since we've had Bush, and goodness knows it's been that long since any Democrats have stood up and been counted against him. But for 3 months now, we've been consistently hearing the phrase by virtually every lawyer and every politician outside the Bush and Republican orbits, the five-word phrase, the president broke the law. And, you know, finally we have at least one member of the Senate who's taking that phrase seriously. Unfortunately, he's had very few other co-sponsors so far. And, I mean, it was really a no-lose proposition for Russ Feingold. It keeps the NSA spying scandal not only in the news, but frames it in terms of its illegality, which had been getting lost in all the Republican and White House spin and all the inaction over the past several weeks, including last week, the decision by the Senate Intelligence Committee under Pat Roberts not only to not investigate the NSA spying scandal, but to essentially legitimize it. And there's now a Republican bill winding its way through the Senate that would do exactly that, that would enable the White House to do any spying it wants for 45 days, and then they can pick and choose whether they decide to notify handpicked members of the Senate Intelligence Committee or not. So it's not really oversight at all, because the Senate has, you know, no power whatsoever over it. It's whatever the White House chooses to tell them. It's sort of a thin veneer of legality over a blatantly illegal operation. Anyway, So the Senate had punted its responsibility to investigate this, and Feingold introduced on Monday a resolution to censure the president as a result. As I said, it was a no-lose proposition for him. It not only makes the Republicans look bad, frames the issue, keeps it in the public eye, but it also forces other Democrats to take a stand. And we've seen what has happened this week. Feingold wants to be president in 2008. What he says is he's exploring the possibility, but you know and I know that that's kind of code language for if it looks like I can do it, I will try. So it gives him a lot of free media. You know, we're talking about him on this program, for starters, and I know how valuable that is. But it gets him a lot of name recognition, which he doesn't really have, being from Wisconsin nationally, and it separates him from other Democrats, as did his effort to filibuster the Patriot Act, as did the McCain-Feingold resolution legislation to try and put some lids on campaign spending a few years ago. I mean, Russ Feingold has done a lot of good things over the years in the Senate, and he has a reputation for being very honest, very forthright, runs very clean campaigns. You know, he's a good guy. And in many ways, sort of the inheritor of the Paul Wellstone legacy. And it's really, really disappointing on this that other Democratic senators, including the two in Washington State, Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. In fact, Patty Murray was one of 20 Democrats who voted in 1998 to censure President Clinton for receiving pleasure from an intern. And you know, if you look at which of those two was a more serious violation of the oath of office, you'd have to say it was Bush. You'd have to say it's more politically advantageous because Bush is in the opposing party and is far less popular. Every poll shows that there are far more people who not only want held Bush accountable, but specifically who support this censure measure. It's a majority of Americans, in fact, that support this censure measure. And yet the media coverage from, you know, the East Coast media organs, the networks, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, has been overwhelmingly negative and dismissive. The political reaction from Capitol Hill has been overwhelmingly negative and dismissive. And Congress, and particularly the Democrats, are completely out of touch with not only their political base, with lefties and liberals, but with the entire American public on this one. And it once again makes them look like they're weak, indecisive, afraid to stand up for what they believe in. And if they keep doing that, they're not going to take back either house of Congress in 2006.
Well, I've never perceived the Democrats' political base to be lefties and liberals, but, you know, they
well,
seem to be corporate board rooms and...
No, that's who the politicians answer to in terms of who the voters are, in terms of who the people are who do the footwork at the precinct level. Those are the activists who tend to be much more progressive than the actual elected politicians. There's a real disconnect there. There used to be a real disconnect 20 years ago between the base of the Republican Party, the sort of church-based Christian fundamentalist right, and, you know, more moderate elected Republicans. And we've seen what's happened to the Republicans over the last 20 years. They're now much more in step with their base, and they've brought the country to the right with them. But the Democrats, for whatever reason, keep trying to move to the center instead.
All right. The Interior Department has a new sheriff this week.
Yeah. Gail Norton left town a few weeks ago, and she's been replaced by another person from the Rocky Mountain West who has an atrocious record on the environment, Dirk Kempthorne, who is a governor of the state of the great Republican state of Idaho, one of the most Republican states in the country. Before being governor, he was a member of Congress from Idaho, and before that, he was mayor of Boise. While he was in Congress, he compiled an exactly 1% favorable rating from the League of Conservation Voters. So that tells you just what sort of an environmentalist Dirk Kempthorne is at the Department of the Interior. And we're going to see, you know, probably more of the same, if not worse, than what we got under Gail Norton. For example, we had just a few weeks ago a decision by the Department of the Interior to open up a vast swath of the National Petroleum Reserve on the pristine North Slope of Alaska to oil drilling. And of course, shortly after that, we had a massive oil spill in the North Slope. And then this week, we had the Senate push through ANWR drilling once again as part of a budget bill. Cantwell was unable to stop this one, so it goes to the House, and it looks like we may have ANWR drilling. This kind of damage is going to keep happening for, you know, until and probably until 2009 when we get a new president at minimum. I really don't see any way to stop it at this point other than, you know, fierce congressional oversight. And that would require Democrats with preferably with subpoena power controlling at least one house of Congress. And, you know, once again, that gets back to the question of what can the Democrats do to make themselves more electable this year other than just standing by and watching the Republicans self-destruct. So Dirk Kempthorne, remember the name. He is a disaster. And keep a close, close eye on what he does at the Department of the Interior because a lot of it is probably going to require public comment and protest. Remember, for example, that there's the pending suggestion of the privatization of massive amounts of U.S. public land, BLM land, all through the U.S. West. Expect that to be pushed forward under Kempthorne.
All right, moving along, the FBI Joint Task Force, is it on terrorism that's been busy?
Yeah, there were actually a couple interesting things in the police state files this week. One of them came out of Pittsburgh, where the local version of a joint anti-terrorism task force, which is a task force of federal, state, local law enforcement officials. They have them in several dozen cities across the United States, including here in Seattle, including in Spokane, including in Portland. When one was initially proposed for Portland, it was a huge controversy. The city council demanded that the police department down there not cooperate with the effort. But here, it sailed right through city council. By I don't remember if it was a unanimous vote or 8-1 or something like that, but the public didn't even know it was happening, let alone have any adverse reaction to it. So we have that here. We've seen now through the American Civil Liberties Union filing a Freedom of Information Act request what kind of terrorism the joint anti-terrorism task forces are investigating, because with so little domestic terrorism and so many anti-terrorism task forces, they've got to do something with all that budget money to keep themselves busy. Well, what they were doing in Pittsburgh was investigating the Thomas Merton Center. Thomas Merton, of course, being a very famous Catholic theologian and pacifist who opposed the Vietnam War, opposed all wars, and his namesakes are doing exactly the same right now. They're pacifists. They oppose the war in Iraq. And from 2002 until at least 2005, the final documents were heavily redacted from March of 2005, and the investigation may be going on. The anti-terrorism task force was investigating, monitoring, harassing, and infiltrating the Merton Center because they were opposed to the war. They came right out and said it. And in fact, one of the earlier FBI reports notes that the Merton Center espouses, among other political causes, pacifism. Well, you know, pacifism is a individual ethical belief. It's not a political cause. But other than that, the FBI watched and took photos while the Merton Center leafleted every week, that being a notorious terrorist activity. They had a report under the heading of International Terrorism Report, gave a rundown on the events listed on the Merton Center's website. I mean, this kind of a thing. And it really is very, very frightening, because these folks were doing absolutely nothing illegal, absolutely nothing that is not only the right of any U.S. citizen, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the responsibility to take a stand on what their government is doing with their tax dollars. It raises the question, this wasn't the Talon program that we've heard so much about that was investigating the Quakers in Florida, you know, another pacifist outfit. Maybe pacifists are the new Red Scare. You know, this wasn't NSA monitoring. This was another agency entirely, and it raises the question of just to what extent dissent has become illegal under the Bush administration post 9/11. There was also a very interesting court-ordered release of documents in New York City this week, five internal memos from the New York Police Department detailing what NYPD was doing to counter demonstrations in 2002, particularly the sort of summit-hopping demonstration that that gathered against the World Economic Forum when it relocated from Davos to New York City in the wake of 9/11. This was the first major anti-summit protest, and actually really one of the last of them also, to follow 9/11. There was a lot of question as to how law enforcement would respond, and now we know exactly how they did it. They did it by a lot of harassment, a lot of monitoring, a lot of psychological warfare against you know, legally permitted demonstrations. They specifically swooped in and arrested 30 people that they identified as, quote, obvious potential rioters. Now, Mike, you've drunk an awful lot of coffee this morning. I suppose that makes you an obvious potential rioter.
Pretty close.
Yeah. Now, the operative word there being potential. The last I heard, it was not particularly legal to arrest somebody on the basis of what they might do in the future, based upon how they looked. So this is really problematic, and particularly so because it's not just New York City and it's not just 2002. We've seen these kind of tactics in virtually every large national demonstration since WTO here in Seattle. And now that we've got the new version of the Patriot Act passed that enables exclusion zones, think no protest zone, and another trail blazed by WTO, made legal by the Patriot Act, that any event of, quote, national significance, the police can now be free to, you know, establish a cordon as far away from the event as they like, and essentially ban any expressions of discontent with it within that perimeter. It's a very scary time for dissent in this country, and we've seen it. I think really since the property destruction in Seattle, which, you know, had such a negative public reaction both locally and nationally, to what was otherwise a remarkably lawful gathering of an awful lot of people, you know, aside from the fact that they were shutting down the event, it was really pretty peaceful until the cops came along. But you didn't get that from the media. You didn't get that in the public perception. And as such, we've seen these increasingly harsh police state tactics over the last 6 years, and the public just shrugging its shoulders and saying, well, they're terrorists. They're criminals. Of course you've got to do this kind of a thing. You know, we've got to start speaking up against this. And, you know, the anti-war rallies today is as good a time to start as any.
All right. Did you want to put in anything else on national? We only got about 10 minutes left. Because you were talking about kind of preemptive police tactics, and this week the White House clarified their preemptive strategy.
Yeah, and not just against domestic dissent. What Bush did, he came out on the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. He's trying to rally support for the war once again. William Rivers Pitt had a hilarious rant. I think it was yesterday, in which he ran down, you know, pretty much weekly mentions by the media of the recent surge of violence in Iraq. It's been surging for 3 years now. Bush came out and said preemptive war is the way to go. It made sense in Iraq, and of course the implicit message there was it will make sense in Iran. we don't have just Iraq to worry about right now, too. We've got Iran to worry about. This is something that the White House is pushing hard for. Iran has already said that next week it will switch from dollars to euros in terms of the currency in which it auctions off its oil, which, you know, could have really bad consequences for the value of the U.S. dollar and, by extension, the U.S. economy, with the trade deficit and the federal deficit being what they are. The U.S. and the Bush administration specifically is really itching to go after Iran, and the whole thing about the potential development of a nuclear program. The rhetoric was very fierce again this week. It's a smokescreen. The White House doesn't care about that at all, and Iran is nowhere near having nuclear weapons at all. But they're itching to go. So when folks gather to protest war this weekend, think Iran also, because we got another one on our hands.
All right, and obviously, as there is every week, there was plenty of developments in Iraq this week.
Yeah, major new offensive by the U.S. military focused on four villages northeast of Samarra, where the mosque was bombed last month. The U.S. claims that it was a major hideout for an operating area for insurgents. They've brought in heavy airstrikes there. Nobody really knows how many yet, how many civilian casualties there have been in the area, but it has to be extensive. And this has been the basis also for a real campaign of disinformation, because what the Pentagon is saying is that it's a joint operation with the new Iraqi army, that they're providing the ground troops, and that this is evidence that the Iraqi military is making progress and will be able to stand on its own soon. Well, that's nonsense. The Iraqi military cannot and will not be able to do anything except as a joint operation with the U.S. military. It has no air force. It has no heavy artillery. You know, it's lacking a lot of the things that every other military in the world has. And not only that, but the United States, the Pentagon, and what passes for an autonomous Iraqi government aren't budging to try and introduce that. And not only that, but the Iraqi army is operating under the command of the U.S. Army, and there are no plans to change that either. Washington is calling all the shots. All they're doing is putting Iraqis in uniforms and using them as shock troops and cannon fodder and as people to put in front of the camera. There is no autonomy going on here at all, and it really puts the lie to the Bush administration claim that they're trying their best to set up the Iraqi army so that they can withdraw U.S. troops. The White House at this point, I think, has no real plans to withdraw U.S. troops at all.
All right. And also this week there was
I should mention also Tom Fox. He was one of the four Christian Peacemaker Team activists who was kidnapped in late November. Their fate had not been heard of since early December, when the last deadline had passed by the previously unknown group that had kidnapped them. Well, we still don't know what's happened to the other three captives from Britain and Canada, but we do know that Tom Fox is dead. His body was found about a week ago. He had been shot before that. Apparently, he had been fairly extensively tortured by his captors. This is a man who was a pacifist, who had worked extensively in Palestine and then in Iraq, probably saved countless lives through his accompaniment work and his work helping ordinary Palestinians and ordinary Iraqis. And his death should have gotten much more extensive media coverage than it did get. He's, you know, as we're celebrating the anniversary of Rachel Corrie's death this weekend also, you know, Tom Fox is another person in her mold, a person who went in there, nonviolently intervened, helped ordinary people, and paid for it with his life.
I think the term would be honoring as opposed to celebrating someone's death.
But yes, honoring. Yeah, sorry.
do for anyone. Just a few minutes left. The UN is looking at a new human rights wing.
Human Rights Council is the new body that was formed this week by the United Nations General Assembly. The vote was 170-4, and you can guess who the four opposing were. It was the United States, it was Israel, and it was the two former U.S. trust colonies, which in terms of international affairs, the United States strictly controls Palau and the Marshall Islands. In fact, Palau, the last time they tried to defy the U.S. was in trying to declare a nuclear free zone, as many South Pacific entities were doing about 2 decades ago. And the governor of Palau was mysteriously assassinated and replaced by somebody favorable to the Reagan administration. And Palau hasn't made many noises of independence diplomatically since. They're known as the Gang of Four in the United Nations because they are the ones who oppose any kind of human rights, any kind of international accountability type measures. They oppose the International Criminal Court, yada, yada, yada. Now the United States has gone on record as one of the only countries in the world, one of only two major countries in the world, along with Israel, that that opposed the creation of the Human Rights Council. Just speaks volumes about the priorities of the United States government.
You'd wonder why the Marshall Islands would go along, since they had, after World War II, been so heavily irradiated by the U.S. nuclear tests down in that region.
Because their economy is completely dependent upon money from the United States. That's why.
Well, just a couple minutes left. Why don't you tell people about what events are happening today?
Yeah. And, oh, by the way, mentioning Israel and Palestine, there was we won't have time to talk about it, but there was a huge event there this week, an Israeli raid on a Palestinian prison there. Real mess, and it happened specifically because Britain and the United States pulled its prison monitors from the Palestinian prison a day before Israel moved in. What a coincidence. And you wonder why the U.S. is hated in that part of the world. Events this weekend. Today, there will be a rally in Seattle on the third anniversary of the Iraq invasion. It's being sponsored by ANSWR. It'll happen at 1 o'clock at the Federal Building. There will be another one, anti-war event tomorrow in Tacoma. Let's see what time this is here. It's, 1:30, I'd say, at People's Park, MLK Way, and South 9th Street in Tacoma. Snow reportedly has transportation from Seattle, although I haven't been able to figure out exactly where that transportation comes from. But you might be able to find that on the web. And then also tonight, in honor of the anniversary of Rachel Corrie's death, honor, not celebrate, honor, 8 o'clock at Westlake Plaza, there will be a reading of Rachel's journals and emails. To give an idea of what she was experiencing in Palestine and the kind of work that she was doing and what her thoughts were before her untimely death.
As well as there's the talk by woman from Iraq who was on the show this morning,
Aman.
Yes. Ahmad Kamas, who is speaking at Trinity United Methodist Church at 7:30 p.m. So two different events for you at about the same time. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is an outstanding, in my unbiased opinion, local publication of local, national, international news, events, comics, humor, opinion, obviously. You can find it where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. You know, for some reason, the Seattle Public Library doesn't want us because we occasionally use nasty words. And you can also help out because it's an all-volunteer outfit. So we always take volunteers. We take donations. We take financial support. If you're interested in doing any of that, you can check out our website where all of our issues and back issues are also. It's www.eatthestate.org. Our blog is located there also, where we pass comment on all these stories and many more. And have fun with a lot of them also, as you might see if you read it. And you can also give us a call with also that kind of feedback or volunteering or whatever, commentary. The number is area code voicemail, area code 206-719-6947.